You're listening to the Script Lab Podcast. I'm Shani Edwards. Today I chat with writers Gene Stupnitsky and Lee Eisenberg about their new film, Good Boys, which, in my opinion, is the funniest film of the summer. We talk about comedy engines, the importance of using alts while shooting, and what they learned writing for TV's The Office. If comedies are your thing, you might want to check out the podcast I did with James Vanderbilt about his Netflix comedy, Murder Mystery. But let's get to Gene and Lee, and a word of warning in case little ears are listening. We do drop a few F-bombs. Hi, Gene and Lee. How are you?
We're good.
Good. So I have to say, I really loved Good Boys.
Go on.
It's an R-rated comedy with children. How the fuck did that happen?
Right? Yeah, we don't know. We don't know how we got away with it.
We hadn't seen it before. I mean, you know, you're always trying to think of something fresh. And we hadn't seen an R-rated comedy with children. And it made us laugh. You know, everything starts with, you know, trying to make each other laugh. So, and this was an idea that a lot of other ideas came from it. You know, it was kind of easy to riff on. And so, you know, what if you put them in, you know, what if it was like an action adventure? What if you put kids in a scenario where it's like, they're, you know, instead of they're running away from the Terminator, they're running away from a 16-year-old girl. You know, instead of, as in Boogie Nights, they're sitting at a drug dealer's house with, you know, firecrackers going off. They're in a frat house, and they shoot it up. So it was a lot of fun to work on.
That's great. Was there any pushback? Did anybody say, you can't do this?
I mean, we got a note early on from someone to age the kids up, that they didn't think it was marketable with this age, and if you made them kind of freshmen in high school, that would make the movie more viable to sell. And we talked about it for a second, and we've seen so many high school movies, and some of them are excellent. And I mean, some of my favorite movies are high school movies. I love Superbad. I love Dazed and Confused. But we've seen all that, and it's not to say that we couldn't do a high school movie. But what we never had seen was, you know, an R-rated comedy, you know, as Gene said, with 12-year-olds. And, we talked a lot about Stand By Me, and we talked about Stranger Things, and we talked about It. And having these things where the nostalgia of seeing kids on bikes, whether or not that's a period piece or not a period piece, it just, when the thing that heartens me when people watch the movie and they say, oh, my God, that reminds me of when I was 12 with my friends, that's exciting. I mean, obviously the comedy, but I think that the movie, I think because you haven't seen it, I think it takes you back to another time.
Absolutely. I definitely got that Stand By Me vibe, a little Ferris Bueller.
Yeah, totally.
I was going to call it a clone. The drone is kind of one of your villains, you know, that's like they're so tempted by that drone.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
What kid wouldn't be, right?
Yeah, we talked a lot about that. Yep. Yeah.
So I loved that. You really balanced tonally the innocence of the boys with the raunchy humor. And I've seen movies where the kids don't get the joke and the adults in the audience do, but this was kind of a little bit different because they just have no awareness of this adult world. And I loved that. Maybe you could talk a little bit about trying to balance the innocence and the humor.
Yeah, you know, we talked a lot about that. A lot of, we talk a lot about comedy engines and where's the comedy coming from characters. And one of the reasons we wanted to make the kids this age is that they're earnest, and earnestness is a great comedy engine. They don't have any self awareness. You know, they'll cry with each other when they get in a fight over something silly,
or they believe that the girl that they have a crush on is going to become their wife. You know, it's like they have no. Everything is at a 10.
Yeah.
And kind of juxtaposing that with them selling a sex doll that they don't realize is a sex doll or crossing the freeway, it's like the stakes, everything at that time feels like the most important thing. It's only with age that you gain perspective. And so for them, everything, you know, the entire day, it's like if they don't go to this kissing party, that forever their lives will be ruined. And as an adult, you're like, I don't want to go to a party. I'm tired. And that's the difference.
I'd rather go home and watch TV.
Yeah. I hope no one calls me.
Yeah. I'm going to put my phone in airplane mode to make sure no one calls me.
So were there ever times when you just thought, oh, this is too much. It's too raunchy. It's too adult.
Occasionally, you know, we'd give a kid an alt and we're like, oh my God, what are we doing?
It would be like, hey, Gene, why don't you give him that one?
Can you explain an alt to my listeners?
Sure. An alt is short for alternative, which is so an alternative joke. So, okay, we got it this way as scripted. Here's an alt. And we did that a lot in the office. We would, you know, we'd have alts at the ready for scenes. And we had them here as well. Because you never know what's going to work. What you think is your best joke, sometimes you don't know. Sometimes a different joke gets a better reaction.
And it's a big... You have to have a lot of confidence, and I don't think comedy works this way. Because when you're a stand-up, you experiment with jokes, and if the joke doesn't work, then guess what? If your show's on a Tuesday, then on Wednesday, you're not saying that joke. When you're in Vancouver and you're not going to edit the movie for another 4 months, it takes a lot of chutzpah to say, this is the joke, trust me. And also, when you give someone a different line, you might end up getting a reaction. You know, the way they deliver the line, the reaction that you get after at the end of it might be the joke. So you're giving yourself all these different options in editing, and comedy is needed. You need that. It's essential for comedy. And Judd Apatow and McKay and Will Ferrell and, you know, Greg Daniels and, I mean, all the people that, you know, we've looked up to over the years, that's the way everyone approaches it. Nobody goes in and says, okay, let's shoot the – I mean, I don't know anyone who says let's shoot the script, but I assume that the movies that we think work less well in the comedy space – are doing fewer alts.
Harold Ramis used to always say, the script is the worst we can do, which is, I think, a good way of looking at it. You do the best you can. You write the best script you possibly can, and you have that as a baseline, and you always try and see if you can improve on it.
Did the boys ever come up and improv the actual best line?
You know, sometimes they would ask. It was really cute. Sometimes they would ask to improvise, and really what improvising was for them 90% of the time was just adding an F word to something.
Well, it's a big difference when you have like Steve Carell and Rainn Wilson and Esteen together and they just start kind of riffing. You're like, oh my God, this is better than anything we've written in years. I can't believe that I do this professionally opposite them.
And then I've never felt that way, but yeah, Lee often felt that way.
And then with the kids, I remember we were on the freeway and then one of them said, fuck you. And then the other one goes, fuck you. And they goes, no, fuck you. And they just kept saying fuck as many times as they could. It was like, all right, guys, we got that version. So let's go back to the scripted version. But they, little things here and there kind of, you know, snuck their way in.
Sure. Let's talk about Peaches, sure. Which is the sex doll. What can you tell me about her?
Wait, do we call her Peaches in the movie?
You know what? You don't in the production notes.
Oh, right.
They say she's Peaches.
That's
but maybe
right.
She's not. What do you call her?
No, we called her Peaches, but I think we cut a part where they knew that wasn't from an earlier draft. That's just funny that
we had a line in an earlier draft where they said maybe we can sell peaches, and that the audience was supposed to think like they're gonna like make $500 by selling the fruit.
Yeah,
and then they show up and there's a sex doll, and then at some point in the rewriting of the script, that line went away, and I don't know that she has a name. We'll have to look at the closing credits.
Sorry, what was it?
I was just curious if you could tell me about her and how...
You like her backstory and stuff?
Yeah, sure.
She's exotic looking.
But I also read that the kids really thought she was a CPR doll. Is that true?
Yeah, well, so they didn't know what she was. They'd never seen anything quite like her. And so we're setting up the shot, and I could see them whispering, and they kind of came up to us. I'm like, and I guess while it was being set up, maybe her dress came up, and they saw that she was anatomically correct. And they didn't normally ask us because we didn't really tell them anything pertaining to sex. We'd be like, you know, go ask your mom. But they're like, why does she have, you know? And we were just kind of frozen. And Stephen Merchant, to his credit, said on the spot, he goes, doctors use this for medical school to practice on. I was like, wow, that is a great answer.
And the kids were like, right, well, that tracks.
Yeah.
I love that so much. Were there any other funny moments like that? Not necessarily with the doll, but on set that you just couldn't stop laughing.
The day that Stephen Merchant was there, I think he was there for a day or day and a half, him improvising with the kids, asking about the sex doll. And, you know, because he was very kind of, you know, he's a consumer. And he clearly knew a lot about the sex doll. And some of his alts were just, and improvs were just unbelievable.
It was definitely the most the crew laughed and we were laughing.
I was convinced I was going to ruin takes. Like, I couldn't breathe. I've never, and by the way, some of them are not in the movie.
Yeah.
Some of them, like, you know, we experimented when we did test audiences. And people were just like, this was too far for them.
It's like that, you know, they say like, how do you make someone laugh? Have them fall. How do you make a comedy writer laugh? Push an old lady down the stairs. It's kind of like that. Like for us, what makes us laugh is probably too far for a normal audience.
I got it. What was the biggest challenge writing for tween age kids?
I mean, part of it is, you know, you're trying to write, you want authenticity. So you want, like, you don't want people saying, they would never talk like this. This is BS. I'm out. But also finding that line between them getting comedy from their sweetness, you know, that they don't understand something. You know, so we've all seen movies and TV shows where there's that, like, precocious child who clearly is written by an adult. We weren't really looking to do that.
And I think, you know, I think there are big set pieces in the movie, but for us, or at least for me, I would say, you know, I love the, you know, when he says, you know, we're taking you to a hospital, and he's like, you know, take me to a hospital, and he says, do you have insurance? And he says, I don't even know what insurance is. He's like, either do I, you know, and like they're talking about deductibles, and it's like, it's like words they've heard at dinner, and they didn't get around to asking their parents, or like, they, you know, we love when kind of side characters have like deep backstories, and so. Atticus, who's kind of the kid who starts the sippy cup chant, when he, you know, we find out that his dad has 2 DUIs and takes the bus to work, and then his mom plagiarized a cookbook, and his dad has been audited by the IRS. It's like they're
listening. Kids hear everything adults say, so they're on the dinner table, or they're in the back seat of the car hearing their parents talk. And you know, do you know that that Bill, you know, whatever, his wife was caught plagiarizing. You know, she got in trouble for plagiarizing a cookbook.
Plagiarizing her, you know, her self-published cookbook. Yeah. Probably.
So it's like, you know, like kids hear everything and then they repeat it.
And I think, like, you know, in the movie, I think it was an alt that we came up with, or someone came up with, but the when they're talking about nymphomaniac, and it's, you know, it means that she has sex on land and sea. You know, that's just like the kind of confidence that Jacob says that, and the fact that the other kids just.
Accepted
as that's, oh, well, that, I guess that's what a nymphomaniac is. That stuff is exciting to us.
Yeah, in the trailer, so I'm not spoiling this, but it does have that. They're trying to figure out what a tampon is.
Yeah.
Look what I found at school today.
What is it?
I have no idea.
That's a tampon.
Girls shove it up their buttholes to stop babies from coming out. An eighth grader told me that.
His explanation that he got from an eighth grader. Yeah.
But it's kind of like, as an eighth grader told me that. So like, as if like, that's the end of the conversation.
That's the
like,
word of God.
Yeah. I didn't come up with this myself, an eighth grader.
That's wonderful. What were you guys like at that age?
Kind of the most popular, girls loved us, guys feared us. No, I mean, I was very into karate. Big into karate. Big into basketball. Didn't play on any teams, but I was big into the sport. And
more of a cheerleader.
Yeah, more of a cheerleader. You know, I had my first girlfriend in fifth grade. Didn't kiss until seventh. You know, it took time.
Slow play it.
No, you know, I think that, yeah, I think I was a pretty normal kid. I was probably a Max. Gene was a Carrie.
I was really into comic books, especially The Amazing Spider-Man. I really loved basketball and Spider-Man. I was obsessed with those two things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I wanted to know if we could talk a little bit about how you guys came together and you spent time working on The Office. And was that as a writing partners, or you met? Okay. Maybe you could talk about how you met and how you got that job.
We met on this movie Bedazzled. In 2000, and Gene was Harold Ramis's intern, and I was the office PA and kind of responsible for the copier. There's an expensive copier, and that was my domain. And I was very proud of that copier. And Gene came in, and we started talking, and we were writing together a little bit, and we became friends. And then we became roommates, and then we started writing together more, and. And then we came up with this idea for a show loosely based on Us, except we replaced writing because we didn't think writing was particularly visual or interesting. We made our characters, Lonnie and Gordo, Lee and Gene, magicians, and we pitched it to Fox with some producers that we had worked with and sold it. And then it never got shot or anything, but that kind of became our writing sample Greg Daniels writer for The Office, and we got hired on the Office at the beginning of season two, and then we stayed on it for 5 years.
That's wonderful. What did working for The Office teach you about writing comedy?
So much. I mean, that was really our education. Long hours just for 5 years. You learn so much. We broke so many stories. And, you know, Greg is brilliant, and he has lots of theories. And, but, you know, you really learn the most by doing and just constantly grinding a story out and squeezing all the juice out of it. And, I mean, we learned so much from him and being on that show and being around so many smart and funny people. So it really forced you to step your game up.
I think that you know, how important rewriting is was key. I think thinking about comedy engines and, you know, so what makes a character tick? What makes someone funny? Why are they funny in this situation?
Yeah, why are they funny at the grocery store? What's funny about them in every different situation?
The way that we approach, when we come up with characters now, we go through the same exercises that we did back then, which is, why is a character funny at a grocery store? How are they funny at a grocery store? How are they funny at a wedding? How are they funny at a funeral? And if you can't answer those questions, and again, you know, then I think you're at a deficit.
You mentioned comedy engines. Can you maybe explain or give an example for my listeners?
Sure. So, I mean, if you think about, let's say, Dwight Schrute from The Office. So what's Dwight's comedy engine? He loves order, and he is kind of, he loves order, he loves power. And so, you know, Dwight at a funeral would want to be a pallbearer. You know, he would think that he could do this. He would be very proud to be a pallbearer. He would think that he could be a pallbearer better than other people. He would, at a grocery store, he'd be obsessed with like finding freshness, or, you know, if he felt like a milk had spoiled, he would be dumping milk out. You know, that would be him. And Michael Scott is someone who wants to be the center of attention. So if Michael went to a wedding, you could imagine stealing the mic and trying to be the MC for the night at a wedding that he doesn't know anyone. And Michael is desperate to be liked, so maybe Michael would try to befriend everyone at the supermarket. And Dwight would be very aware. He would stop someone who did, you know, 12 items or less, and he would force that person to go to the back of the line. And so, whether or not anything I'm saying is funny, those are comedy engines. So you understand what George Costanza. George Costanza is petty, so you know what George Costanza would be like at a wedding. Maybe he'd try to like sneak cake, or he'd find out that there's gift bags, and he'd try to take two, or whatever it is. And so when you think of characters that are iconic characters, you can kind of slip them into everyday situations and know how they'd act. And in your own scripts, if you can't answer that question, then your character has no personality.
That's such a great explanation. I really appreciate you going into that for me. Can you learn to be funny, or is it something you grow up with?
Most comedy writers and comedians oftentimes weren't, you know, the captain of the football team. There's something about being an outsider that lets you kind of see the world through a particular point of view.
Or you observe. You were kind of quiet, or you weren't popular, so you're kind of on the outside looking in.
I did once hear a story, though, that, and he shall remain nameless, that a very famous showrunner, when he was 18 years old at Harvard, was voted least funny in his dorm. And that summer he went home and checked out every book in the library about humor and comedy and studied it and came back. And he's now a successful comedy writer. So
good.
I always think about that. Yeah, I always think about that.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
I think you can get funnier. I think you can learn. I think there are not tricks at all, because I think every time that we try to write, or I try to write, I feel like it's the first time. But I think that there are joke structures that, you know.
Yeah, like rule of threes, or, you know, yeah, whatever. But also, you know, there's also, everyone has like, there's so much bad stuff you have to get out of your system by just writing and writing and kind of, and it still comes back. We still write bad stuff all the time. But, you know, it takes, before we sold our first thing, we each wrote plenty of bad scripts.
Writing and comedy writing is really hard, and, you know, the writers on The Office are as good writers as we've ever encountered, but we're still working till 11 o'clock at night, and we sometimes work till 2 in the morning, and it was very rare that we didn't stay for dinner. So clearly Greg Daniels, who I think is as good at what he does as anyone, and Mike Schur and Mindy and BJ and Jen Salata and Paul Lieberstein, these people are incredible. But we were still, like, nobody, it's not like we said, oh, we should do an episode about healthcare, yeah. and then all of a sudden it just miraculously appeared. It was, you know, weeks and self-doubt that you arrive at something.
And we would all write bad scripts occasionally, and not even occasionally, all the time. We'd have to rework them. It was hard, you know. We kept rewriting and rewriting until we got it to a place where we felt good about it.
I would say writing across the board is incredibly hard. It's not like, I think, like, for me, it's like whatever I'm not doing, I think is like, oh, you know what, I should be in TV now because we just did a movie. Or, you know, movies are so much easier, so much more gratifying. I mean, you know, we started working on Good Boys 5 years ago. So it was this was not a speedy process.
Yeah, we came up with Bad Teacher 7 years before it came out. You know, all these things take forever.
Yeah.
So when you guys are working together on a script, do you sit next to each other? Or do you send it back and forth? How does that work?
We're usually in the same room. Occasionally we'll Skype back and forth, but normally we're in the same room. I know writing teams that email back and forth. There's something that happens when you're with the person that, I mean, for us, like, you know, we'll write separately. Once we've outlined, we'll write the first draft separately. But most of the work, the real work, happens when we're together and rewriting.
That's great. So I'm working on an R-rated comedy script.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. What advice do you have for me?
I think it needs to come from character. I think it needs to come from story. I wouldn't, like, if the goal is like, oh, I'm going to do something audacious, then I think it's going to feel audacious for audacious's sake. And I think that's the wrong approach. I think, why is it R-rated? Is that the best version of it? Or is that because you think that R-rated comedies sell easier than PG-13 comedies, which is actually completely wrong. But I think that it's like, what's the idea and what are you trying to say? And how are these characters now?
Yeah.
Regardless if the character's 80 or 6, how are they navigating the world?
Character will lead you to everywhere you need to go. I mean, once you know who that your main character is, you'll know what they're going to do. And that, you know, so the fact that it's rated R, it may be rated R, maybe it doesn't need to be. It doesn't really matter. It's just like, who are they and what are they doing?
Got it. Any advice for writing multiple protagonists as you did in Good Boys?
I think it's just distinguishing characters. I think every character needs to live on their own. And I also think what we try to do with our writing is, even like, to us, Soren has a backstory, you know, the cool kid, or Atticus, we were talking about his parents. Like, we really want everyone, to exist as if they could have been the star of their own movie. And the cop, when he walks in, it's like, I read so many writers where they lack detail. There's no texture to any of the scenes. And so it's like, one thing we talked about a lot on The Office, and actually Ivan Reitman talked to us a lot about, was scene play and enlivening every scene. So it's not just, if the purpose of the scene is X, it's like, okay, but life isn't like that. So life has other things. So if a character is if the scene is about a couple breaking up at a dinner at a restaurant, okay, well, that's what the scene's about. But is it funny that the waiter keeps coming to tell them about the specials? Is what else could be happening so that the scene feels alive and not just about the thing that, you know, from a plot standpoint, needs to happen.
What are you working on next? Can you tell me?
Yeah, we're doing a remake of A Star Is Born.
Jacob Tremblay.
We feel like it's time to do another one.
And I hope everybody goes to see it. It's a perfect summer movie. And I wish you guys the best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Awesome.